one standard for intelligent design, but they don't want to accept the same standard when it comes to Darwin's theory of evolution.
That's Richard Thompson, chief counsel for the Thomas More Law Center, that's defending the Dover Area School District in a lawsuit to stop students from being told about intelligent design before biology classes on evolution. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to be talking about that court case in Pennsylvania and intelligent design for the next 25 minutes of Issues Etc. Dr. William Dembski is our guest. We'll have open lines after our conversation with Dr. Dembski. I want to know, how important is this issue to you? Are you watching this intelligent design debate that's taking place in various school districts throughout the country, the creation debate with intelligent design? Have you been following it? And if so, is it an important debate, and is the outcome important to you? I want your answer to that question in about 25 minutes. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. William Dembski is a professor of science and theology at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, and he's author of the book The Design Revolution, Answering the Toughest Questions About Intelligent Design. Dr. Dembski, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Is intelligent design, as many say it is, a Trojan horse for bringing God, the Bible, and religion into public education?
No, I would say it's not. I mean, you have to look at this debate at several levels. I mean, we're talking about biological origins, and that's immediately going to have implications either for theism or atheism. Will Provine at Cornell University has described evolution as the greatest engine for atheism ever devised. So people are going to go with these ideas and run in various directions, but you have to look at what the theory itself is saying. Now, intelligent design, what it is, it's the study of patterns in nature that are best explained as the result of intelligence. Intelligent design as such actually covers a much bigger ground than just biology. I mean, search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Is that radio signal coming in just random radio noise, or is it the result of an intelligent alien? If you've seen the movie Contact, you know what that's about. That's a scientific program. Archaeologists, is that rock that I'm looking at an arrowhead, or is it just a random chunk of rock? Problem is, when you get to biology, if you start asking, well, is this feature of a biological organism the result of intelligence or just natural forces? The question is, well, who would that intelligence be, or what would that intelligence be? Now, that it within a Christian context, you know, you're naturally going to say, well, that's going to be God somewhere downstream. God's going to have been responsible for that. But those are not the only options for interpreting it. I mean, Plato, Aristotle, Stoic philosophers would be design theorists today, but they did not hold to any sort of theism as we do. I've spoken at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies, told them about intelligent design. My message was warmly received. They're not theists. So even the implications theologically and philosophically go much further than creationism as it's traditionally understood, I mean, strictly within a Christian context. But then you've got the whole scientific program, which stands on its own merits. So there are lots of dimensions to this debate, but at its core, there is a scientific issue. If there were not a problem with conventional evolutionary theory, and if intelligent design did not have something new to bring to the table, we wouldn't be talking right now. Okay, I mean, it's not like whether the Earth is flat or whether the Earth is stationary and the sun goes around the Earth. Those are not topics of discussion because those have been thoroughly discredited. Intelligent design is very much on the front burner because there are real issues of intellectual and scientific merit there.
Dr. Dembski, I'd like you to respond to Nick Matzke of the National Center for Science Education. He says that intelligent design, the book that's being used in the Dover School District in Pennsylvania, and it's being recommended there, is in fact a misleading book.
The intelligent design movement generally misrepresents the science. Oftentimes it gets it completely wrong. So anyone who actually took the book seriously would just completely misunderstand many areas of biology.
Dr. Dembski, what's the book, and how do you respond to Matzke?
Well, the book is Of Pandas and People. It's an intelligent design textbook that was published initially in 1989. The edition that's in question here is 1993. The only thing I think that could be a problem about it is that it's a bit dated. I mean, there's an awful lot that has happened with intelligent design, but in terms of giving an overview of what the program is about and how it is different from evolutionary theory and what the problems of evolutionary theory are and why something like intelligent design is needed. I think it's an admirable text. I mean, one thing you have to understand with the other side in this debate, they adopt what I would call a zero concession policy. It's not to their advantage to allow that there's any merit to our criticisms of evolutionary theory. And so this is the consistent pattern you get. It's very dismissive. I think it's just something to be aware of. There are, on the flip side, evolutionary theory is not a slam dunk. What gets taught in all the textbooks is this neo-Darwinian version of evolutionary theory. It is debated. It's highly debated. Even if you leave aside intelligent design, there are deep questions. There are problems with the theory. I mean, certainly the fossil record is a problem for it, but the bigger problem these days is in molecular biology. You have the cells are chock full of high-tech engineering gadgets. I mean, this has been discovered now in the last 30 years. I mean, signal transduction circuitry, information processing, retrieval, storage, digital data embedding technologies. I mean, it's a marvel of nanoengineering, what you see inside there, and it is completely unaccounted for in terms of the standard evolutionary mechanism. So you've got a theory that claims to the grand claim is that nothing in biology makes sense apart from this theory, and yet, in fact, there are vast areas in biology where this theory offers no insight at all.
So when we hear it stated, as it often is, that evolutionary theory is the foundation for all modern biology, all modern teaching of biology, that is simply too broad a statement. It doesn't explain everything that needs to be explained.
It's not just too broad a statement. It's just patently false. I mean, many biologists don't even take an evolutionary biology course. There's no need for it. I mean, you look at a biochemistry text, there'll usually be maybe five or so references to evolution. They're ritualistic references. They're just there because evolution did it, but it has no explanatory role at all in the text. I mean, most of biology is nuts and bolts stuff trying to figure out how things work, and evolution offers very little insight into that. So I've got a good colleague. He's actually a witness, good friend and colleague. He's a witness in this Dover case, Scott Minnick. He's an expert witness there. He never took an evolutionary biology course. As he puts it to me, I didn't have time. I was too busy doing other things.
Let's also get your response to Eugenie Scott of the National Center for Science Education. Scott says that students shouldn't be reading a statement about intelligent design before classes on evolution.
It can always be worse, certainly, but this is not a modest issue. This is not a baby step approach to the bringing of religion into the public school curriculum.
Your response, Dr. Dempsey?
Well, I mean, we've discussed this already about the role of religion in this debate. Yes, there are religious implications, but the Pan of Pandas and People is not a religious text. I mean, it's very clear to say that that you can't get from the data of science to any sort of god of religious belief.
I'm wondering whether or not evolutionists are willing to concede that while there may be religious implications to intelligent design, there are certainly also religious implications to evolutionary theory. It is as much a religious statement to say that there is a God as it is to say that there isn't a God.
Yeah, but what you're going to find is, and this is what Philip Johnson has referred to as a two-platoon strategy. You have the mainstream biological community, or mainstream evolutionists. When you actually look at the theory of evolution, there's no place for any sort of guidance intelligence. I mean, this is supposed to have been Darwin's great contribution to have eliminated teleology or design from biology. Francisco Ayala, well-known evolutionist, will say that. But then they turn around because most of the U.S. public does believe in God. Well, you know, what gives here? Is it possible to reconcile the two? And then usually what's said is, well, yes, you can believe in evolution and hold to a belief in God. But basically what they do is they just segregate the two. It's as far as our best science goes, there's no evidence that there's any sort of intelligence or purpose working there. But that's how God did it. I mean, it's sort of a schizophrenic, you live in two worlds view. And that's what they usually say. So it's you can be a theistic evolutionist, but the theism doesn't do any work scientifically. From a design perspective, we're not even saying that it is God. I mean, it could be a space alien for all intelligent design is concerned. I mean, that raises problems of its own, but that has actually been seriously proposed by none other than Francis Crick, the co-discoverer of the structure of DNA and a Nobel laureate. I mean, he's got a theory of directed panspermia, where space aliens come and seed planet Earth. They have to do that because the origin of life is too big a problem to account for just with the processes that he's aware of on planet Earth.
That's an interesting take. It's just passing the problem of the origin of life off to an unexplorable realm.
Yeah, I mean, but that, in a sense, it does make it an ID, intelligent design, problem. I mean, it's now space aliens. But the question, the bottom line question is always, are there patterns exhibited in these biological systems that are best explained as the result of intelligence, whoever or whatever that intelligence is? And that's a question we can pose. And if you cannot pose it, in a sense, then biological evolution, as it is taught, becomes a default position. It's not something that even becomes testable. I mean, Darwin's Origin of Species, if you read the book, there are over 100 references to creation or design in there. It's the proper foil to Darwin's theory. He needs it in order to establish his theory, because design does explain various aspects of the biological world. So he has to say, but my theory explains it better. But if there's no foil or counterpart, so then basically you have something that just becomes a monopoly. It's just that's the default position. There's no way to test it anymore.
So now, it suffers from evolution as evolutionists would want it, suffers from an inability to be falsified in any way.
Yes.
The truth of it cannot be proved by any, there's no that could falsify it.
If there's no evidence that could count for intelligence, then what do you have left? I mean, something like Darwinian evolution is the only game in town at that point.
Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. William Dembski is our guest. He's professor of science and theology at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, author of the book The Design Revolution, Answering the Toughest Questions about Intelligent Design. Let's go to Pennsylvania, to Valley Forge. Jeff is listening on the Internet. Jeff, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Dr. Dembski. It's a pleasure to talk to you. This Sunday, actually, on a local talk show, I was actually able to talk to the gentleman who wrote The Republican War on Science, where he badmouths intelligent design. And actually, the host gave me, I was able to go back and forth with this guy for about 5 minutes, which was kind of nice. And at the beginning of the call, what he was trying to say is that science can't find any evidence for supernatural, or can't prove anything about the supernatural, if he's trying to say, science is limited to discovering things about the natural realm, I understood. But what it seemed like his confusion was, and it seems like, I'm not sure if it's purposeful confusion or just the party line or what, actual confusion. It seems like they're skipping between they can't find, the question about whether you can determine design and the implications of that answer, and it seems like they don't like the implications of the answer, therefore a priori, before even get into the argument, you're not allowed to, even discuss intelligent design. I kind of showed the logical errors in that, and then he kind of started changing his tune to, well, there's no good evidence for design.
Yeah.
So I was wondering...
Well, that's often how it goes. I mean, what you're talking about, Chris Mooney, he's the author, and he has a thing for intelligent design these days. The usual argument that's made, I mean, he's recycling this, and this is a standard script now, is that science studies natural causes, but intelligent design is introducing a supernatural cause, so intelligent design is outside of science. Now, this is a bit of fancy definitional gerrymandering. The real question here is, what is a natural cause? What is the nature of nature? And the thing is, all of these people define nature as basically material processes working by unbroken natural law. So it's not nature as such, but nature conceived as a purely materialistic entity. So it's particles in motion, energy, matter interacting by unbroken natural laws. And once you assume nature is like that, indeed, no intelligence can get a foot in the door. But one of the things that intelligent design is raising is, well, what is the nature of nature? From our vantage, intelligence is a perfectly natural cause. I mean, right now we're talking. We're intelligent beings. Is there something supernatural going on here? No, we need intelligence to understand what's going on in nature. But what they have done is they have defined science and nature in such a way that intelligent design is excluded. And, of course, once you define it that way, then intelligent design does get excluded. You know, so a lot of it is just prying apart these presuppositions and these smoke screens and these definitions which are designed to keep intelligence out of science as a causal power. And intelligent design is bringing that to the fore. And I think when we succeed, I mean, it's not just going to be biology that's changed, but how our whole conception of science.
It seems to me this is really a debate about information. And that is there information in, say, the human genome, which the evolutionists would concede? But information doesn't arrive out of thin air. Information has its organization, its content, is in fact design, one way or the other.
That's our argument, that the sort of information that we find in biological systems requires intelligence. But they will turn it around and say that information can be produced by a historical process, namely evolution by natural selection. And this is where a lot of the theoretical work is going, and I've got what I regard as an important paper on that topic. I call it Searching Large Spaces. But, I mean, there's a lot of discussion, which is actually technical discussion and really is pushing forward the science. But what we're talking about here is, in fact, a lot of political posturing, trying to keep intelligent design at bay, characterizing it as creationism, because creationism has been defeated in the courts in the past, so let's identify intelligent design with creationism so that we can keep intelligent design at bay.
How do you account for the fact that evolutionists routinely, even now, even well aware of the debate with intelligent design, routinely refer to organisms or biological systems as being designed? I was listening to, in fact, a debate between evolutionists and advocate of intelligent design, and the evolutionist was talking about how a certain organ was designed. Mm-hmm. What do they mean by that?
Well, what they mean by it is that it was designed by an evolutionary process. I mean, Richard Dawkins, in his book The Blind Watchmaker, he's an evolutionist, will write, "Biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose." But it's merely an appearance. I mean, the language of design is just a placeholder, as it were, for adaptations that are the result of this blind, purposeless material process. So they use the language of design. It's convenient, but they don't mean what we mean by it.
Do you think that if, laying aside politics, laying aside legal wrangling, do you think that in time intelligent design can at least be considered popularly as an alternate explanation to what evolution purports to explain?
Well, I think my aspirations are quite a bit beyond that. I mean, the problem is I don't think evolutionary theory counts as a science at this point. I mean, if we're talking small-scale evolutionary changes, that would be fine. But that's not what makes the theory interesting. I mean, it's not how insects develop insecticide resistance that gives traction to evolution. It's how do you get insects in the first place? And there's absolutely no evidence that conventional evolutionary mechanisms, those that were described by Darwin and his successors, can bring about the biological complexity that we see in these systems. The evidence is just not there. And this is not just intelligent design people saying this. I mean, I can just trot out quote after quote from evolutionists, or biologists, I should say. They're usually not evolutionists, but biologists who say, look, there's some serious problems and deficiencies with evolutionary theory. So I think it's going to go well beyond that. I mean, I don't think it's just that there's going to be peaceful coexistence with evolution and intelligent design. I mean, if you've read Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn, There is no peaceful coexistence with theories that are this diverse and have such different presuppositions and are going in such different directions. It's going to be one or the other that's going to triumph in this.
So with 1 minute, what then is, to your way of thinking, the inevitable outcome if in classrooms around the country intelligent design is put forward through textbooks and teaching and whatnot as an alternative to evolution?
Well, I think it will hasten the acceptance of intelligent design. But even if it doesn't happen, I mean, let's say this court case goes against. I mean, worst possible scenario is that the judge says intelligent design is religion, not science. And let's say that goes even all the way up to the Supreme Court and that they rule that. I don't see that as stopping the progress of these ideas. I mean, the work will continue. We will get our stuff published in the peer-reviewed literature. We are already. The momentum is building, and eventually I believe that scientists will vote with their feet. The good problems, the interesting research is going to be from an ID perspective. I'm already seeing that. And so scientists will vote with their feet, and eventually the courts and the public schools will get in line. I hope it's sooner rather than later, though.
And to those who say if intelligent design is allowed as a viable subject or even really a mentioned alternative in public education, then the biological sciences and everything connected to them will simply fall apart in time. Your response?
it's just fear-mongering. I mean, design has a long, illustrious history, even in biology, teleological thinking, and it will be just fine. And a lot of biology proceeds without any evolutionary assumptions at all. It's structural. It's looking at how things are structured, what they do. It doesn't even appeal to evolution. So biology is going to be just fine if intelligent design gets in there.
Dr. Dembski, thanks for being our guest on Issues Etc. again.
Thank you.
Dr. William Dembski is professor of science and theology at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. He's author of the book, The Design Revolution, Answering the Toughest Questions About Intelligent Design. When we come back from this break, I want to know what you think about it. Is this important? I mean, aside from reading about it in the paper and saying, oh, that's interesting, a couple months ago it was in Kansas, now it's out in Pennsylvania, they're arguing about evolution. Is this an important issue to you? Do you have a stake in how this debate eventually resolves itself between intelligent design and evolution in the classroom? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. The other question I have is a little more fundamental, and not strictly speaking on the issue of intelligent design, but on the issue of creation. Be honest with me on the other side of the break. We've got 20 minutes of open lines. Do you believe in a literal six-day creation? Six consecutive calendar days ending with the seventh upon which God rested. That's the basic outline of the Genesis account. Do you still believe it? I do. And I'm not asking you to call so we can argue. I want to know. Do you still believe it? I'm beginning to wonder how many do. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. See, for me, an awful lot rests on a literal reading of Genesis chapter 1 and 2. An awful lot rests on it. I want to know if you think it is, well, an indispensable part of what you believe as a Christian. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. This break is a great time to call. Do you think the ID evolution debate is important? And do you believe in a literal six-day creation? We'll be right back with Open Lines after this.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We've all heard about the unrest, atrocities, and persecution in the Sudan. Well, LCMS World Relief is on the front lines of providing comfort and hope through several projects. They're helping to provide emergency food for children in southern Sudan, school books and supplies, grinding mills for Sudanese in refugee camps, and enhancements to St. Paul Lutheran Medical Center in Khartoum. Now, for more information on how you can help support relief efforts in the Sudan, look for the LCMS World Relief logo on our homepage, issuesetc.org. Their phone number, 314-996-1683. Late last year, the Republic of Sudan and the Sudan People's Liberation Army reached a peace accord. Many Sudanese who fled their homes will be returning. You can help the resettlement and the education of these refugees by supporting LCMS World Relief. Issuesetc.org or 314-996-1683. LCMS World Relief.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Dr. Lester Crawford's resignation as Commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration is fueling the Washington, D.C. rumor mill. Some say the abrupt departure results from the extended comment period he gave Plan B, the morning after pill. Others think he made a bad decision by approving the abortion pill RU486. Bill Wilson reports.
Planned Parenthood hailed Crawford's resignation as a victory, citing his request for public comment on Plan B. But Wendy Wright of Concerned Women for America says the FDA's approval of a second drug, RU486, the abortion pill, was problematic for Crawford.
The FDA has reported several women have died after taking this drug, and yet the only action the FDA took was to change the wording on the warning label of the drug. So we've been very disappointed with the FDA's action on that, allowing this dangerous drug to stay on the market.
Crawford was a casualty of a culture war, according to Dr. Gene Rudd of the Christian Medical Association.
There may be other things we don't know, but you know, the first casualty of war is truth. And sadly, we in our society think that science will be the determinant of truth, and it's far from that.
Connie Mackey of the Family Research Council says President Bush now has an opportunity to choose wisely.
We can only hope that the president will make sure someone who takes over at FDA understands the severity of the kind of drugs we're talking about for women, RU486 and over-the-counter morning-after pills.
Washington insiders agree the FDA is a major battleground in the ongoing culture war over abortion. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bill Wilson in Washington.
The FDA is mum on why Crawford left, only confirming his resignation. Planned Parenthood, which released a statement saying women's health suffered under Crawford, did not return requests for comment. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Join Joni Harwell and me, Diane Summers. We'll talk with Joe Dallas about his book, When Homosexuality Hits Home, What to Do When a Loved One Says They're Gay. And Mike Yankowski talks about his experience as a homeless person living on the streets for 5 months in his book, Under the Overpass. It begins at 11:05, Living Jubilee, on AM 850 KFUO.
Was the Book of Mormon given to Joseph Smith by an angel or created from a work of fiction? Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September is titled, Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon? You can find out more by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or look for the cover of Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon on our website, issuesetc.org.
Open lines, issues, etc. for the next 25 minutes, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, one free phone line. Let's start with Jeff, who calls from his car. Jeff, welcome to Issues, etc.
Yeah, I was calling about your question a second ago regarding the seven-day literal creation of the world.
Yes.
And, frankly, for me, it's not important that God created it in a literal 7 days. I try to read the Old Testament through the lens of Jesus Christ, and when I do that, there are things that are not debatable, and there are some things that, you know, I think, maybe we can talk about and think about and look at different perspectives on.
All right, let's see how far you are going to go with this, and I'm just exploring your viewpoint here.
Sure.
Someone might say, okay, day doesn't have mean day. Maybe day could mean a week. Could you go for a 7 week creation?
Well, and even then, I think the premise of the question isn't important to me. It doesn't matter to me how God created or how long it took God to create. To me, the important thing for me is that God created, and he created it to have community with us, his creation. and to give us dominion over the earth. To me, that's the important part.
All right, so for Jeff, it's not important. Thank you very much, Jeff. I appreciate the call and for your honesty as well. I'll have some thoughts on this in just a minute. Brent calls from his car. Hi, Brent.
Pastor Todd, how you doing?
Doing well.
Thank you. By the way, favorite show on the radio.
Very good to hear it.
Thank you for talking about my favorite topic as well, creation. I am a literal 6-day, 7-day creationist. The previous caller mentioned that what's important is how God relates to his creation. And although that is the important thing, what I would say to that person too is don't forget that what God tells us is important. We know that God cares about relating to us because that's what he tells us. And God, what's interesting is when we look at the Ten Commandments given to Moses, we see it introduced in Exodus as, and then God said, you know, commandment, commandment, commandment. When we get to the Sabbath, we see, remember the Sabbath, they keep it holy, for in 7 days, you know, in 6 days, God created all things, and on the seventh day, he rested. So from the mouth of God, we're hearing that those are literal days.
So for you, the importance of holding to a literal 7-day creation cycle, according to Genesis 1 and 2, how would you summarize that in one sentence? What is at stake for you in holding to that viewpoint?
Well, I think commenting even the previous caller, what's essential, name me a Christian doctrine that isn't found in Genesis. I think we, you know, see creation, we see the fall, we see pointing messianic prophecy in there. So I would say to that person, you're concerned with what Jesus, you're seeing Jesus, well, what did Jesus believe? He certainly took Genesis as being literal. I think we should, too.
Thank you very much, Brent. Next up, calling from his car, it's Dalen Dare. Welcome to Issues Etc.
Hey, thanks. Appreciate it. Good show.
Sure.
I just caught you on the radio and flipping through the channels, and I really appreciate it because of the situation in which most people argue this out. The 7-day calendar of creation, as I was telling your call screener there, that I was always raised through a Christian church and the denomination, under the Baptist faith, that the days was considered as 1,000 years, but then again, it could have been 1,000 seasons. And as far as the creational factor of importance to me is because it's the faith that God had said, this is what I did. It is for you to understand that it was done for you. Otherwise, the other factor you have between... I lost my train of thought.
Let me ask you this question. Maybe we can get your train back on track just a little bit.
Okay,
so it's not necessarily important to hold to a literal 6-calendar-day creation, according to Genesis. Could God have done it over, say, 60 million years and through the process of what scientists today call evolution?
No, I don't believe 60 million years. That's why I was referring to a season versus a year, because there are some discrepancies on how the calendar of that time period was based on a season, 4 seasons being a year, or is that 4 years? That's not debatable. God said he created the earth and the heavens and the earth in 7 days, and on the seventh day he rested. But like I was saying, though, I was always taught that a day could have been 1,000 years. That is not the situation. Sorry about the little bump. I'm in a tractor trailer, not actually a car. But we're just talking about intelligent design. If God didn't have a hand in intelligent design, we would have, pardon the crazy pun here, but you would have a brindle bear. You would have a bear, a polar bear, mating or pairing with a grizzly. And that just doesn't happen. So in nature and naturalization itself tells you there was some kind of supernatural being, and I prefer in my heart to say it was God, that had a design to say, hey, polar bears are polar bears, grizzly is a grizzly, a tiger is a tiger.
Dalen Dare, thanks for the call, and thanks for catching us there as you spin across the dial. Always nice to have new listeners that way. All right, so we've got two say not so important that it is 6 days, although Dalen Dare is pretty careful to say, look, the time period, he does believe God created it the way it says he created it. Scott's up next calling from St. Charles. Scott, welcome.
Hey, Todd. How you doing?
Doing well.
Yeah, to me, it's absolutely essential. I'll start out, you know, as the one caller referred to Jesus, I obviously believe the literal Genesis, you know, when he said, you know, in the beginning God created a male and a female. I think when you read the text of Genesis, even to a simple-minded person, even a child, you know, there was the evening and the morning the first day. You know, we know an evening and morning is a cycle of 24-hour cycle, more or less. If you move away from that view, then to me, you have to start thinking about, well, evolution, there was death before Adam sinned, and that's just not in a biblical framework at all. So, it's just critical to me. And I think of what, I guess, really God said to Abraham when he came to tell Abraham that Sarah was going to have a baby, hey, is anything too hard for the Lord? And I think the only reason that we try to wiggle out of a literal day is because of the influence of the secular evolutionists. So that's my comment.
All right, Scott. So Scott is willing to say it's essential that we take this to be what it appears to be according to a plain and simple reading of the Genesis text. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, one free phone line. Let's talk with Charles, who calls from his car. Hi, Charles.
Yes, Ted. Todd, thank you very much. I definitely believe in seven-day creation. I believe what God says. I believe for a variety of reasons. A couple of the comments that I was going to make, your previous caller already did. If indeed there were thousands and thousands of years, death had to be part of the evolutionary process, and Romans 5:12 precludes that. Also, my question to those who insist upon a long period of time, I ask them why. What's the necessity of requiring a long period of time? And, of course, the influence comes from the secular evolutionary thought process, which demands millions and millions of years. Secondly, evening and morning, light and dark, night and day, plus the symbiotic. Are you familiar with the word symbiotic?
Yes.
Symbiotic relationship of plants and animals and the whole thing would really be upset if indeed we followed the scenario of the 6 days of Genesis and the actual creation of the certain plants and animals without a particular balance of all of them at the same time. We would have very, very much difficulty in reproduction with some of them, for instance, because of the nature of the relationship between them. I don't know if I'm making sense there, but
no, you're making sense, and I understand what you're saying, Charles. Thank you very much. And what Charles is saying is, when it is in 6 days, I mean, just understanding it from the way we understand how animals and plants and all of the systems of they call them ecosystems work together now, they have to show up pretty much at the same time for them to work together the way they work together now. There is an odd order, you know, because the sun and the moon don't get created until. After the plants. Now, the evolutionist said that could not be, but I think to confound our reason, God did it in that order. Who's up next? Stan, calling from his car. Stan, welcome to Issues Etc. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, I belong to the Creation Research Institute. I get their newsletter, and I also read the Intelligent Design blog every day.
Sure.
And I believe that the 6 days is a literal 6 days, and it's essential for understanding all of the Bible. And knowing that God has infinite intelligence, something that I think Dr. Walter Lang told me one time is that the question is not did God take 6 literal days, but having infinite intelligence, why did he take so long?
That's a very good question, one to which Scripture provides no real answer yet. We will certainly have an answer in time or eternity. All right, so I'm looking here at my list. We've got several who say it's not important, and so far three in a row saying this is essential. Literal six-day creation, essential for a variety of reasons. Up next, Bob calling from his car. Hi, Bob.
Yes. Hi. How are you?
Very well.
I'm just floored. I can't believe that people wouldn't find this important, and I think that we have to ask what the Word says. And the word for day, if I remember correctly, I don't have the Hebrew in front of me, but the word is yom. So if you say that it's a season, for instance, 1,000 days or 500,000 days, if you insert that into the rest of the translation in the Scripture, it absolutely makes no sense. And I think that you have to ask yourself the question, is can God explain things in the Scriptures in a simple fashion, or does he not know how to communicate? And so I think that it's absolutely imperative that, or that you know, you need to believe that it's a six-day creation, that he rested on the seventh day.
Bob, thanks for your thoughts there. Surprised that some would consider it less than important. Bill's up next, calling from his car. Hi, Bill.
Yes, sir. Most of the previous calls have pretty well said what I want to say, but God can do what he wants to do. And Jesus referred to Adam. Paul referred to Jesus as a second Adam. So Genesis is acknowledged by both the Lord and by Paul. And if we're going to question the six literal days, why can't we question the real presence in the Lord's Supper? If you're going to throw one out, you're going to have to throw the other out. They can't stand without each other.
And there are some who probably would do just that, Bill. Thanks for your thoughts. All right. Let's see who's next. John is calling from his car. John, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello, Pastor.
Hello.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. Something I'd like to point out, I do believe it is essential as well. But the point I'd like to make is, following in Genesis, doesn't it say that Adam lived to be 900-something years?
Something in that neighborhood, I believe, yes.
And it doesn't say he lived to be a million and something. For me, I think that's important because there's time between sixth and seventh day. And if you follow with what I'm saying, if you live to be 900 and something years.
That's right. I mean, Adam, along with this, you know, you pointed out something very interesting, perhaps without intending to do it, John, and that is along with this, the historicity of those two people is in question as well. That is Adam and Eve. That's the next question you want to ask someone who says, well, it wasn't a literal 6 days. And then you say, okay, next question, even though that raises a lot in and of itself, what about Adam and Eve? Were they real historical people? Were there a first two, Adam and Eve? And when it says Adam lived 900 and whatever years, is that also kind of fudging the real story as well? You see my point. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Calling from his car, Rich, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, good afternoon, Pastor Wilkin. Yes, I have to say that believing in a literal creation is important, that Adam and Eve truly existed, as you just mentioned. If they didn't exist, then there was no fall. And interpreting everything Christologically, well, if there wasn't a fall, then there was no need for Jesus to save us. So it all hinges back to that. There was a real Adam and Eve, there was a real fall, and so we need a real Savior.
Nicely put, Richard. Nicely put. Let's see. Everything appears to hang on this. I mean, everything eventually appears to hang on this. Millie in Arlington Heights, Illinois. You've been patient. Millie, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so glad that this opportunity to have this conversation with you. I think that it's important that the intelligent design arguments in courtrooms go forward, because we lost it in the Scopes trial. Even though they won the trial, it was a disaster for our educational system. And when I was a young girl in high school, I lived in a state that did not permit the teaching of evolution. And I asked my teacher to explain to me what that theory was, and she said she couldn't. And I really don't think that that was correct. But the situation now is just the reverse. And you cannot even mention in a public school any idea of intelligent design or point out the errors in evolution. And there are many. Unfortunately, even an individual, a young student going on to college these days, will come up with this question, and they will have problems, especially if they're in the scientific area, of being able to go on, even though their grades are good, if they don't believe in evolution. And I think that the argument needs to be addressed now for the good of the country and for the good of our young students.
Millie,
who
thank
are
you.
Being taught these things that are in error.
Thank you, Millie. So Millie's point here, if to understand it clearly, Millie's point is it was wrong not to at least acknowledge and understand evolution when it was not permitted to be taught. It is equally wrong now the people evolution is taught almost exclusively to our young people, it is equally wrong now not to acknowledge alternate theories for origins as well. Bill is listening in Los Alamos, New Mexico. Hi, Bill.
Good afternoon, Todd. I guess no one has actually addressed your first question, and I do intend to do that. So you first asked whether the intelligent design debate is important. I think it is, for reasons that may not be clear, and that is that I believe it attempts to preserve a place for personhood. I don't want to spend too much time on that. But the second aspect, too, which I think most people miss, and I spend a lot of time trying to clarify this with people I work with. I should emphasize that I'm a scientist, a physicist, and so all the people I deal with are PhD physicists and the like. So the second aspect of intelligent design that Dembski hasn't made clear in his talks, but is very important, is that intelligent design is actually divided into two aspects. One is a meta-analysis of scientific paradigm, which is a tool to analyze some present scientific paradigm. And independent of that is the use of that tool. The use of the tool is what people mostly dispute and never discuss the meta-analysis of the tool. The second part you ask is a very difficult question for me, six-day creation. Now, I'm an LCMS member, and I have to say that this has, over the last 10 years, caused me a lot of grief.
What is OCMS?
LCMS.
I'm sorry, LCMS.
Yeah.
Should have heard that one, yes.
Yeah, sorry.
What's caused you grief? Who hold to the position or those who don't?
It's a form of infectum, which I've tried to get pastors to address, but they never want to address it from this aspect. Meaning that the thing that people seem to miss, and I think a lot of evangelicals who I spend a great deal of time with in this topic seem to miss, is that there are very good reasons for believing in a old, not just an old evolution, but even an old Earth, and an old cosmology. They're all very good reasons for this. It isn't just evolution that's in question here. It's the entire modern astronomy that's in question.
Well, we can't go into all those details, Bill, but let me see if I can bring this down with one final question for you, and that is, are you saying that you are still at this point struggling with a literal reading of the Genesis account, a plain and simple reading of the Genesis account and a six-day creation for a variety of reasons? Is that fair to...
Oh, it's not fair. It has to do with doubt, and it has to do with the fact that, you know, many aspects of a Christian faith can entail doubt, meaning that there are good reasons to doubt it. And so I still hold for all the reasons that people have given here in a six-day literal creation. But one should not overlook the fact that there are good reasons to doubt it, and that this is a form of infectum.
I see what you say, Bill. Okay, now that I understand that completely. And that is, look, the Bible has something to say about this, and I think it's pretty clear. But do I, in the dark night of the soul, ever wonder, wow, could I be completely wrong on this? Now, there are, and our listeners have given many of them, strong theological reasons that undergird my belief in a literal six-day creation. But that does not mean that when I look at various evidence that is brought forth by the evolutionary community, that it doesn't sometimes make me wonder. It's not a wonder so as to renounce what it is I believe, but I'm thinking, well, you know, that raises a pretty good question. And I don't know if I even have an answer for that question, which I think is kind of the definition of doubt. Thank you very much, Bill. I'm glad we got that clear. Rick in Columbus, Indiana, you're up next. Rick, welcome.
Hi. Hey, it was a pleasure to meet you the other day.
Very nice to meet you as well. I should have told Jeff. I forgot to tell Jeff. I met Rick at it's Grace in Columbus, right?
Uh-huh.
I met him there on Sunday morning. It was good to meet you, too.
I believe in the literal 6 days, and just what you said about doubting from time to time when you see things. I think, you know, if we're all honest, we would have to admit that we do doubt from time to time. But by the grace of God, we do believe his word. And pretty much everybody said what I was going to say. I was going to talk about Christ being the second Adam. And also Paul in Romans said death reigned from the time of Adam to the time of Moses. So clearly he was talking about Adam being a real person. And also, if we believe that we impute the righteousness of Christ through faith, we also have to believe in Adam and that we impute sin from him.
So. Okay, so you're back in Romans again, and I appreciate these theological arguments. These, to me, are the most compelling reasons to take Genesis at its face value. Now, people would say, well, it's compelling enough because it's in the Bible. Well, that's true. That's true. But the word day in the Bible can mean something other than 24-hour sun-up, sun-down kind of a cycle. It can mean something other than that. Now, context is king. Don't let me forget, before we close out this conversation, we're going to carry this on into the next hour. Don't let me forget, because I want to mention something I'd be willing to send anybody who emails me at twilken, T-W-I-L-K-E-N, at kfuo.org, a little something I've written on, I think it's called Seven Questions for Old Earth Creationists. People who say, well, God made it, but it wasn't six calendar days. Judy calls from McCook, Nebraska, listening on KNGN. Hi, Judy.
Yes, hi, Pastor Todd. Haven't talked to you for a while.
It's been a while.
Yes. I'd like to throw in something else in the mix here.
All right.
If we're going to, you know, not believe in the 6 days of creation out of the Genesis accounts, then we have to throw them out of the Exodus accounts, too, especially Exodus 20, on remembering the Sabbath in the law.
Yeah, it's certainly, that is another argument that is, I think, is a great little buttress to much of what we've been talking about here, Judy. I thank you for bringing it up. Now, the two questions we're dealing with here during Open Lines, we'll carry it over on the other side of the break. First, we talked with William Dembski, probably one of the brightest light in the intelligent design movement, just a few minutes ago. We spent some time talking about the debate that's taking place in courtrooms between, should we teach evolution alone? Should we teach evolution alongside intelligent design? Can we even have a disclaimer informing students before biology class that there's something other than evolution out there in the scientific community? Is that debate important to you? We've had several callers weigh in on that. Millie said, yes, it's very important, as well as Bill responded positively there, too. But my question for you, in a related but not parallel way, because intelligent design and six-day creationism are two different things. That needs to be understood in no uncertain terms. But my question for you that most of our callers are answering, do you believe in a plain reading of Genesis 1 and 2, a literal six-day creation? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. To the callers waiting on the line, be patient. When we come back from this break, we will take you at the very beginning of the third hour of Issues, Etc. Our in-studio email address, if you prefer that means of posting a question or a comment, issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org, and our call-in numbers again, 1-800-730-2727 or 505-7850. We'll continue our conversation about intelligent design and creation on the other side of this break. Then, as time permits, we've got a few other things for you during the last hour of Issues, Etc. Stay tuned. Stay on hold. We'll get to those calls right after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.